Welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. I try each episode to post some thoughts to help get this conversation started about a viable, helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality. And I want to thank many of you who have commented or submitted questions. I integrate those comments either into episodes or definitely into the book at the end of the project. So we're now in the second section of the project, and we're asking this fundamental question. Does religion have anything to offer sex education? The title of today's episode is this, Religion and Sex, A Slow Hand and Easy Touch. It's part two of three. We could think of the process of forming a human pair bond similar to the way metal alloys are formed. Alloys are stronger than either of the constituent metals are individually. However, if an alloy forms too quickly, if the environment isn't right, if the temperature is too hot or too cold, it becomes brittle. In a sense, that's also how sexual bonds form. There are internal mechanics that are required for the bond to form well. Now, in sexual bonds, these processes happen shaped in the heart and in the mind. Erotic touch serves to support these interior processes, but the heavy lifting is done internally. In the last episode, I introduced Dr. Desmond Morris, a noted zoologist and anthropologist, and his study of human pair bonds and how they form. He correlates physical touch with stages of physical touch with the essential psychological and emotional processes that attend each one of those stages. In this episode, we'll look at his first three stages. We'll look at the interior processing that goes with these stages of physical touch. Next episode, we'll look at the remaining nine. So let's begin. The interior processes that correspond to these first three stages of physical touch are really get ready to form a bond kinds of processes. He names the first stage eye to body. Not eye to the sexy parts of the body, but the simple act of seeing another. I see you, I notice you. It's a process of discovering. It's a process of desiring another. But it's also awakening to one's own availability. His second stage, eye to eye, is the stage of mutual discovery, mutual attraction. On the outside, our eyes are noticing the other. On the inside, we're making space for discerning our own availability and our own desire. We're assessing if the other is as available as we are. He calls his third stage voice to voice. On the outside, we're having initial conversations with one another, but inside, our hearts and minds are working to tell our story and to hear the story of the other. I tell you who I am, you tell me who you are. We're making space to determine if our initial attraction, our initial availability, is sustained once we discover one another's personalities or values, life's desires. Three stages, each of which sounds pretty simple, but each of which requires a more demanding inner work than it appears at first. My youngest son is almost 20. He's growing up, and it's dawning on him how psychologically and emotionally demanding relationship building is. And like every other young person, he spent his teens testing himself in the big wide world. He knew he was cherished at home, that he had made it with us. But the question he and all young people have to answer is, can I make it out there? So when our kids were growing up, we did a thing. We called it the Hammock Family School of Character. Whenever Denise and I taught our kids about some virtue or character trait, and we did that a lot, we always couched it as a lecture or a lab in the School of Character. So we teach them about discipline or work ethic or honesty or flexibility or resilience. And of course, they'd roll their eyes. That's what kids do. And we'd say, well, you know, it's just school. What are we going to do? Now, the day each of them left home to go out into the big wide world, we woke them up early in the morning with a family parade into their room. And we'd wake them up blasting pomp and circumstance through the whole house, and we bought some diploma holders and printed up a diploma, and we stood by their beds, and we read a graduation decree, and we'd laugh, and we'd hold a mini ceremony with them still in bed, and then we'd pronounce them graduates. We wanted to communicate to them as clearly as we could that they had made it in the family system and that they were prepared to go out into the big world. We believe that, but for each person, the real test is if they believe that. They have to figure it out for themselves, prove it to themselves, prove to themselves that they have what it takes. One of the primary areas of concern that young people face is this question. Will I make it out there with a potential romantic partner? In other words, will someone that I want to be with me? And that pressing question, that pressing concern, drives the teen passion for dating. There's a pressure to hurry dating because it's a pressing question. When young people fret over the prom or having a boyfriend or a girlfriend, they're asking, will someone I want me? And driven by that question, all of our kids brought home special friends during their teen years. Being on the other side of the question, of course, we'd advise them to slow down, but again, it's their pressing question. So, our son was home from college for a few weeks. His dreams about the future were starting to become clearer. His vision for the kind of career that he might have, his insights into his own abilities and how they might fit into the world. And as this was becoming clearer to him, he was realizing that there's a lot to do to get ready for life. There's education to finish. There are jobs that help with personal development and some cash. There are lots of young people growth opportunities to explore. There's a breadth of possibility out there, possibilities that take time and energy and passion and bandwidth to explore. And to give them the time they merit, he was doubting in our conversation if there was time to give a relationship what it needs to prosper and flourish. Now, I'm biased, but he's a smart kid. Unwittingly, he had stumbled into the wisdom that is religion's gift. He figured out that there is a significant amount of upfront work required to establish a sexual relationship that can thrive. It is work. It takes time and energy and focus and attention. It's difficult to have bandwidth for both a relationship that is moving forward on the sexual journey and at the same time to be establishing oneself in the adult world. This is the focus of Dr. Morris' first three stages of the sexual journey. They focus on non-touching processes, on interior processing that helps assess our own availability. It helps us assess our readiness for an endeavor as demanding as a sexual relationship. When I was young, like many, I grew up on fairy tales. But I didn't grow up on the sanitized Disney versions. I grew up on the grittier German version, the Grimm's tales. These were stories filled with young people facing hard times and daunting adversity. Some were facing a boiling pot and the threat of being eaten. Others had to slay dragons or outsmart trolls. They had to overcome some challenge before they could attain their destiny. Well, when it was time, I read those same stories to my kids when they were young. When my wife would hear some child being eaten or threatened to be eaten, she'd call in from the other room, "What are you reading to them in there?" But I wanted them to hear the wisdom of these old stories, because these stories speak of young people being tested and being prepared, seeking their fortunes or facing down giants or witches. And a recurring theme in all of that adversity in those ancient tales is that facing down the big bad world prepares us for adulthood and readies us for a sexual partnership. Because in the stories, if the young person found their fortune, or if they slew the dragon, or they outwitted the witch, or they outmaneuvered the troll, if their mettle was tested, and if they survived the test, when they came home, they got the prince or the princess. They won the hand of their beloved. Going out was a time to stretch and grow and be readied for the interior demands of a sexual relationship. It was a process that convinced themselves, yes, I am ready. I do have what it takes. I can make a relationship work. Young people must become the kind of people they need to be to win the prince or the princess that they want. So, here I was talking to my son. He was asking the same questions his older siblings had asked. They're questions people ask in these early stages. Am I ready? Sure, I'm sexually attracted to this person, but am I ready? Have I captured my fortune? Have I slain my dragons? Have I outwitted my nemesis? Have I proven myself to myself? Do I have what it takes? Do I have the resolve or the courage or the tenacity that the sexual journey will demand of me? So, Morris's first three stages are much more demanding than they sound. They're not really about physical touch. They're about what happens in us when we start to notice the kind of partner we want to spend our lives with. While we are attracted but not yet touching, we're asking some really important questions. Who is the me that I will bring to a sexual relationship? Have I developed the inner capacities that I'm going to need to do this well? So, while he was home, my son and I went to breakfast, and I told him what I first told his older sister and brother Of course, you want to assess a potential partner on the sexual journey, but the dominant focus in these early stages of attraction isn't about the person you're attracted to. The dominant focus is about your own readiness and your own preparedness. And I pointed out to him, look at this dragon you had to go up against last semester. Yeah, you got singed a little bit, but look how well you came back at it, and you slayed it, and you did very well. Now look at this dragon that you've still got before you next year. Now what you learned the last go-round, that's going to strengthen you for what's ahead, and you'll probably get singed again, but I bet you'll prevail again. And once you've done that a few more times, the you that you bring into relationship will be ready. A few more times, and you'll know that you're the man you need to be ready for a relationship, to win the kind of person that is worthy of spending your life with. I reminded him what I taught his sister, our first child. For most of history, I taught her, people purchased their spouses. Back then, they called it a bride price or a dowry. A young woman and her family would accrue resources to present to the family of a young man. If it was the man that the young woman really wanted, odds are the dowry had to be sizable. The same thing happened for a young man who was courting a young woman, but it was called a bride price. Now, today, the currency of exchange has changed considerably. It used to be that a bride price or a dowry was land or titles. Other times it was gold or hard currency. Other times it was cows or goats or sheep. But I told my kids, for most of history, people purchased their spouses, and I taught them we still buy our spouses. So you still want to accumulate a dowry, because you'll want to be able to shop around for the kind of man you really want. Now, of course, she scoffed at me in disbelief, and I said, no, it's true. The only thing that has changed is the currency. Instead of gold or land or cows, the currency with which we buy our spouses is the investment we have made in ourselves. In other words, I taught her, if somebody has invested in their character or their emotional intelligence, or if they've developed courage or diligence or honesty, that's currency. It's currency in their spouse-buying account. That's the dowry with which we shop around for a husband. It's the bride price with which we shop around for a wife. Rarely, I would tell my kids, does someone who has invested deeply in their own character choose to spend their life with someone who hasn't. Without personal investment, we don't make it on the list of the prince or the princess that we want. Rarely does someone invest in their education or their career development or a business and then choose to spend their lives with someone who's lazy. As we invest in ourselves, I told my kids, we make deposits into our spouse buying account. It's not a very romantic way of looking at it, but it is kind of a transaction. I said, it's a little bit, choosing a spouse, is a little bit like buying a car. If you only have a little in your car buying account, you come home with an unreliable car, one that costs you in repairs and gives you trouble and doesn't last long. But if you have plenty in your account, you come home with a reliable car. It even has air conditioning for the hot days and a heater for the cold days. You get a car that's got all red circles in consumer reports that won't give you repair troubles. It will last a long time. So I told them, invest in yourself to build up a spouse buying account. Invest vigorously and then shop shrewdly. Now, as I've said, religion does have wisdom to offer the sex ed curriculum. But part of that wisdom is that there is an upfront process that is necessary to form pair bonds that last. And religion has advocated for making sure these processes have time and space to happen. And first on the list are the get ourselves ready processes. It's demanding to get ready. There's a lot of psychological work, emotional work, personal development work to do. And all that happens before we're ready to move into the erotic stages of a relationship. There's personal readiness, personal investment, personal development. In Morris's early stage, eye to body, eye to eye, voice to voice, we haven't yet kick-started the chemical force of erotic touch. We grant ourselves, we grant the relationship time and space to get ourselves ready to form pair bonds that can last. While we are not touching erotically, we are making an honest assessment of our own availability and discerning our own readiness. And we're making time to assess the other's availability and the other's readiness, the other's preparedness. Watching another from a distance, eye to body, eye to eye, we measure some important things like character, things like personality. We assess how does the other handle his or her life. And we make those assessments before the chemical intensity that erotic touch pumps into our systems. Before the wild ride fully kicks in, we're making an assessment of the other's suitability and readiness and availability. And we do it while there is still some cool light left in the day, before erotic touch kicks off the chemical bonding process. As we watch, eye to body, eye to eye, as we converse, voice to voice, we assess ourselves, and then we reveal ourselves. We assess how much we have in our own spouse buying account, and we assess, is it sufficient to capture the attention and the affection of the kind of person that we want to spend our lives with? And now all of that stuff, that does not happen easily, and it does not happen quickly. It's demanding work, psychologically demanding, emotionally demanding. Pacing the bonding process this way, we create space for our imaginations to work. This is an important thing that's happening during the get-ready stages. Imagination is one of the most important tools our brains have. It helps us get ready for what comes next. By imagining ourselves with the object of our affection, by imagining the kind of person that we will be in that context, and the kind of person the other will be, we change ourselves. As we aspire to be the kind of husband or the kind of wife we want to be, as we aspire to capture the affections of the kind of husband or wife we want to be with, we are working deep changes into our lives. Imagination does that. Focused imagination shapes us, and it shapes our internal worlds. And when we give ourselves the unhurried, deliberate pace to practice imagination, because you can't hurry the mind or the heart, we, in giving ourselves that, we afford ourselves growth and change and readiness. On the other hand, hurry is exactly what erotic chemicals do when we engage in erotic touch. Sex chemicals push us forward. They hurry us toward the culminating act of intercourse. They hurry us toward orgasm. That's how our bodies are designed. That's how the species keeps going. But the early bonding stages invite an unhurried process, unhurried change dynamics that are embedded in our own imaginations. They give us space for personal assessment and development, and they invite all that work to go on before the full fury of sexual chemicals kick in. Then, voice to voice shifts our work from personal readiness to personal disclosure, which also takes time, time to reveal ourselves. Even if we're willing to fully disclose to the other, it takes time for the environment to be right, time for memories to surface, for personal insights to bubble up. But we're not always willing at first. It's natural to put our best foot forward when we want to attract another. So it takes time to reveal an honest assessment of who we are. It takes time to gather an honest assessment of the other person. When I was dating, several older women took me on as kind of a pet project. They advised me on dating issues, and several of them used the same phrase when they were talking to me. Maybe they were consulting with each other, but they said this: when you choose someone, it's a good idea to summer them and winter them. It's a good idea, they explained, to see how a potential mate holds up over time. We can all put our best foot forward for a while, they advised, but to get a true picture, we need to observe them under stress as well as at ease. We need to see them when things are going well as when things are tough. We need to observe how teachable they are when life throws a curve. We need to observe how dogged they are when the times are difficult. We need to observe them, and we need to observe ourselves. Spending time with these early stages of the bonding process gives us time to reveal ourselves for who we are and time to study one another for who they are. It gives us time to assess compatibility, time to see if our initial attraction builds and grows or diminishes over time. It's important internal work, work that's difficult to do under the pressure of erotic bonding chemicals. Because once we start erotic touch, it becomes very difficult not to move the relationship forward. It becomes very difficult to hold on to any semblance of objectivity. So in a culture that has courting rituals that give couples this unhurried time, time for this internal work, pair bonds tend to last. Those that don't, don't. Now, notice what is not present in Morris's first three stages. There's no hands in pants, no hands up shirts. There's no tongues down one another's throats. When we narrow our definition of sexuality to erotic touch, it looks like not much has happened yet. Nobody's even gotten to first base. But quite the contrary, a lot has happened. But it's been interior work, emotional work, psychological work. It's been inner preparedness work, work that is necessary to bring the me into relationship that can sustain a deep pair bond. Now, as a minister, I'm often present when pair bonds dissolve. It's a sad part of my job. But when they dissolve, a lot of times, the self-awareness that we work out in these early stages somehow got stunted along the way. The interior capacity that is hammered out in these early stages, the self-awareness, the self-disclosure that gets worked out before erotic touch kicks in, often those skills have not developed very robustly. I'm on vacation while I'm writing this part of the project. I write in the mornings, and then in the afternoons I've been watching old episodes of The Office. In one episode, Michael Scott is struggling with sexual awkwardness. And traditionally, he says, the third date is the time to have sex. And then in his stumbling and humorous way, he tries to navigate the challenges of sexuality. But because I'm working on this project, that phrase stuck out to me. Traditionally, the third date is the time to have sex. Now, many have a sense that that's a pretty normal timetable. If we've gone on three dates and we still like each other, it's not uncommon to think that intercourse is the next step to move the relationship forward. But Dr. Morris's studies suggest that the internal work that's necessary for a stable pair bond can't unfold on that kind of short timetable. Now, as a culture, it is a pretty normal tempo, but as a culture, we also see a lot of brittle pair bonds. The two are at least correlated, I suspect, causal. Normalizing a pacing that gives our minds and our hearts and our self-awareness and our personal development space and time. This is an important part of the successful sexual journey. The wisdom of religion, the wisdom of stacking the upfront work up front, has been to normalize patience, to normalize deferring eroticism. This is one of the important contributions that religion has. This is a wisdom that could afford our young people a better chance at relational and sexual and emotional health over a lifetime. All right, in the next episode, we'll look at the internal processes that are at work once we do start erotic touch, and we'll see that there, too, a slow hand serves us well. As always, I hope you'll comment, ask questions, but if this question applies, I'd like to hear what you're thinking. If your sex education had religious influence, what'd you pick up that you think is worth keeping? We've already taken a hard look in the last few episodes at where Christianity went wrong, but as we dust off the things that we were told, is there anything good in there? What has served you well? I'd love to hear about it. All right, next time.